before we start the conversation. Hello, everybody. It is absolutely my pleasure and my honor to be here. And I thank Bing for making this happen. And thank Mark for will be able to speak without having to give a speech. And Western standing together, thank you. You are a model for our nation. West Marin, the North Bay, the West Coast has been a model for our country. It would be a miracle if most of the country could figure out why it works here and learn to do the same kinds of things we do. But before we have our conversation, I think I have to tell you where I'm coming from. First of all, I never in my worst imagination and nightmares thought that Donald Trump would be nominated as the candidate for the Republican Party for president. In fact, I had bets with people that I hardly knew because I was so sure. And I had to take all kinds of people out to lunch and got nominated. Then I was totally, totally certain. See, I've always had a really good political head. And it just goes right there, and I have always been able to count on it to be really accurate. Well, I was sure he was not going to be our president. And how wrong I was. I still don't trust that he won the election legitimately, but I have no way to prove it. And I hope someday somebody will and would be willing to admit it to our country. Because I can't believe that our country would pick an individual that would come to us without any plan, without knowledge, without curiosity, without any appointing people with good minds and good people to guide him where he doesn't know anything. An individual without experience or real interest in government or governing, and without a belief in the truth. That's what's happened to us. So when I'm up here tonight answering questions, and when you ask me questions, you have to know that that's where Lynn Woolsey is coming from. I can't pretend I think it's going to be all right unless there are some major changes in the way we do business in this country. And I don't blame just the Republicans. I don't blame just the crazies in middle America. I blame us all. Something has happened, and we let it happen. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. And you're standing together, so your community will do something about it. And I look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Sorry.
Here we go.
So, do you hear me?
Yeah.
What you see up here is a reporter and a politician. But as you know, those interchanges can get a little testy at times. But really, what you're seeing is a retired politician and a journalist who is retired for today. I'll start work again tomorrow. But this is a conversation between two people who don't know each other. We've met, but we don't really know each other. But we have been watching the same things from a different perspective for our careers. I've covered politics on and off for 50 years. I've watched politicians in action. I have grown increasingly cynical about our political representatives, with some exceptions. And I'm sitting next to one right now. And I'm honored to be sitting next to Lynn Woolsey. 20 years in the Congress, 10 elections. Previous to that, served in the Petaluma City Council. Never lost an election. How many politicians do you know that never lost an election? You know, I think if she had decided to stay at it, she would have been sailing back into office over and over and over again. So she's not in office now, and so we can't stand up, as it's happening all over the country, we can't stand up and shout at our elected representative. And I think that's a healthy process, incidentally. I think calling our elected representatives on their deceptions, their lies, their inconsistencies, and everything in public is a healthy part of the democratic process. But we're not here to do that tonight because Lynn is not our representative anymore. However, I do want to start, Lynn, by asking you to pretend for a moment that you did run and win, and of course you would have, and you were back in Washington again, serving us as you did so well for so many years. What would you be doing now? What would be your focus? What would be your major concerns? And who would you be working with and against?
My major focus would be to convince the Democratic Party that they have to forget business as usual, that they no longer can do business the way we've done it. I mean, I was totally part of it for many years. There's a new game in town, and the Democrats have got to wake up. It's very different to be on the inside fighting for what you believe in, by the way. And for me, it would have been for workers' rights and for peace and justice I would have been begging that we put everything we had behind a huge investment in our infrastructure and jobs for normal people. That's what I did when Obama was first elected. The very first Democratic caucus we had, I stood in front of everybody, and here comes Lynn, she's gonna say something. Now's the time. We have the House, the Senate, and the White House. Now is the time to put people to work, you know, with a huge, huge investment in our infrastructure. People glossed over, it wasn't gonna happen, and it didn't happen. If it had, we would not be where we are right now. The grassroots, the normal, regular workers would have been earning a livable wage. So that's what I've already sent a message to Leader Pelosi saying, come on, you guys. Everything I hear from you is about money, 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 money. Tell me what you're going to do with it. Come up with three or four things that matter to this country and start talking about it and mean it and stay with it. Because we can damn Trump and his cronies all we want, but we have to say what we would do that's different. And I would have said that right there if I was in the House right now.
The standing committees, the subcommittees of standing together reflect a few of the major issues that we're facing now and that have risen to the surface as a consequence of this past election. But that's only that's the short list. I mean, the list goes on and on. And so if you're sitting as a representative in Congress, you're looking at all of these issues. They're being thrown down on your desk day after day after day. So healthcare, Medicaid, budget, Russia, immigration, the Supreme Court, taxes, leadership, the environment. No, it just goes on and on. The growth of the country. And you have to pick your shots. I mean, you can't I don't think any one person, even with a good staff, which you did have, some of your staff were here incidentally, you had a great staff, but you cannot address all this. So what would be, right now, if you were there, what would be the issues that you would focus on and have your office focus on?
Well, one, it would be whatever, I was on the education committee and labor, workforce education committee, and I would have been, my staff would have been, number one, working on international relations and preventing blowing up Korea. I would have gone down to the floor every day and talked back to Trump on whatever had happened that night. I mean, you never know. I mean, it's, you wake up in the morning and you don't know what he did during the night that was gonna put our country at jeopardy some more. But I would have been working on peace in the Middle East, on fixing health care, not destroying it, on, oh gosh, it's so hard because I'm not there now and I'm not doing any of this, and on an infrastructure program, and jobs for average Americans. And I think politically, even though I was a total Hillary supporter, I would have by now realized that my leadership in the House was not going to change, and that I would have probably moved to being supportive of Bernie Sanders' ideas. I know that, but I didn't do that to honor you. that is just becoming very clear to me. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have won the election, by the way. Mm. No.
No, he wouldn't.
No.
So, yeah. 20 years in the Congress, there must have been some high moments and some low moments and some lots of meeting moments. What was the most positive, unforgettable moment of your 20 years?
Well, it was Bill Clinton's first State of the Union, mm-hmm. when he referred to our Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, mm-hmm. who is the epitome of what a welfare mother can become.
And you were one of only three welfare mothers that have ever served in the Congress, as I believe Barbara Lee and Gwen.
Gwen, yeah.
And so yeah.
And there's.
Are you a caucus?
No, but we're all in the Progressive Caucus. I can tell you that. And there are others who have not acknowledged it.
Okay.
And it wasn't until. And Barbara Lee will tell you this, that she came to Congress and she had never told anybody she was a welfare mom at one point. And I said, come on, you don't admit it. I mean, I've admitted it. I mean, we set the example. And from that point on, yeah. And Gwen was never, ever embarrassed about any of it. She knew.
What all of these little organizations around the country, like ours here, are doing is looking for points of resistance and trying to be realistic about it. There are certain things we know that are almost impossible to resist at the local level, and this is local level resistance organization. So I don't know whether you've given a lot of thought to the whole notion of resisting proto-fascism or whatever, however you want to describe what we're faced with here. But there are realistic and unrealistic ways to do it, and that's what Standing Together is exploring, and all of the other groups are exploring the same thing. Do you have any advice to locally active people who are committed and concerned and looking for soft targets to fight the resistance that they have to fight.
Yes. And I've been invited to many of the local groups. And the first thing I say is, be so thankful you live where you live. I mean, you just don't know how different it is in other places. And the people that represent you need to be appreciated. And by the way, nobody appreciates Jared Huffman better than Lynn Woolsey does. So you know that I love him. So when you're asking your elected officials, demanding that they do what they need to do, know and learn whether they're already doing it. So then when you need to communicate, thank them for doing it, mm-hmm. and let them know you appreciate it and you expect them to keep on and you'll support them. It's not easy to be a Californian in the Congress because you see, we get made fun of. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, Woolsey, Marin County, you know, you guys don't need anything. And I said, well, excuse me, yeah, these are the highest taxpayers in the country. I think they deserve their share of support coming back so that we can help the people that need help in our community. But the thing I have the hardest time with activists and activism, of which I am one and have been my entire life, and it was way easier being on the outside than on the inside, it's splitting hairs. Mm-hmm. If you've got a person that doesn't see it exactly like you do, but does the right things, give that person some credit. And don't be mean to them. It's not worth it. It's too hard to be good in the first place.
As you mentioned, you were chairman of the Progressive Caucus. You were also, I believe, a member of a smaller caucus called the Reformers Caucus of Issue 1. Would you tell us what Issue 1 is and why it's so important to you?
Right. Well, Issue 1 has just come into fruition the last year since I retired. And Senator Worth called me, he's retired also, and said, Lynn, why aren't you part of this? And there was about 25 people part of it. Past elected senators, members of the House, governors, and mayors of big cities, bipartisan, and either retired or resigned or lost their elections, are coming together to work on what I believe is the only issue that's going to make a difference in the long run, and that is to get money mm-hmm. out of politics.
Tim Worth, full disclosure, Tim Worth courted my sister years ago. So he's a friend of the family. And Tim Worth, when he quit the Senate, and he quit the Senate, he wrote a front page article for the New York Times, Sunday Magazine, which you may have read, which I didn't say, and it is one of the most scathing indictments of money in politics. He talked about the minute the day you're elected, you have to start raising money for the next election, right? And how unfortunate that was. He wrote the article, and that was his quitting document. And senators just stopped talking to him. So that was the ultimate betrayal. As a son, which is kind of a brotherhood now, a brotherhood, sisterhood, but back then it was even more of a brotherhood. They felt they'd been betrayed by him because he raised this issue of money in politics. So I'm glad he's after you and he's and after everybody else.
Well, I joined, and there's 150 members now, and it's about 40-60, 40 Republican, 60% Democrat, but it's got to be bipartisan, and there's a bipartisan piece of legislation out that's sponsored, backed by Issue 1, and it's how to reform the FEC. And we can't go right, we can't change Citizens United right now, but if by, in a bipartisan way, we could start making things happen. Because it's both, it's Republicans and Democrats, elected officials, that have to leave their offices in the middle of the day, go off campus, and start dialing for dollars. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to do that so much, because one, I wouldn't, and two, it just was, it just made no sense to me.
Well, you also were representing a district that loved you and would probably not, that we weren't going to get a very serious challenge. Knew that it was kind of a foolhardy gesture to run against you. That's all the more impressive that you got involved with an issue that wasn't really as much your issue as it is some of the opposition.
Right.
Good for you.
But it, and it's, the Democrats are just as culpable in this as the Republicans, because big money, you know, it's bipartisan, and big money rules in many, many situations. And if we want to have the people of this country be represented, they have to be represented by people that aren't having to worry about the top 1% of the richest people in the country before they think about what their constituents need.
So one of the common debates, which I'm sure you've been drawn into, thrown into, or dove into, is the place in progressive politics and the role of the, particularly the left sides, of identity politics. And I wondered if you have given any thought to whether identity politics has been a good, bad, or insignificant thing for politics, particularly the Democratic Party.
By identity politics, you mean that a slice of what you're interested in, and you make all your decisions based on how a particular...
Well, people aligning their politics with their ethnicity, with their gender, with their sexual preference, with something that they are really, really, really identified with, unavoidably, perhaps. And that becomes their
litmus test,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's so much out there, so I think you have to find your core. But I don't think everything you do has to be based on that. But if in your core, the most important thing to you is that women have freedom of choice, and you've got a really good candidate but doesn't believe that, you probably won't support that person. But what I think is there's too much, and we're saying the same thing, but it's, there's too much narrow thinking. And we are a country that's having such a hard time thinking big and expansive about what really matters and what to do about it. And when you get narrow, then you get narrow about what the solutions are, and you will only support this solution, even if there might be a combination of solutions that will get you, that can actually happen, and would get you to an end result that would at least start making things better, such as the Affordable Care Act. We never intended that, the Affordable Care Act, to be the end-all, be-all. We knew it needed a lot of fixes, but we had to get it started. We also knew that it was very complicated.
One of the things that I and my colleagues in the media are so grateful to you for is the role, aggressive role, but really not high profile role that you played in whistleblower protection. And we rely, as never before, on whistleblowers. And of course, we in the media are very confused by the government's position, which is like really mercurial, position on whistleblowers, particularly the Obama administration, which was saying, encouraging people to blow the whistle and then punishing them for what they're doing. And you played a very, very, like all of your roles, it was low profile. You had to be watching closely to see it, but I was watching closely because I'm interested in protecting whistleblowers. So could you talk a bit about that and why you became so interested in whistleblower protection?
For the very reason you said, we encouraged whistleblowers and then we set them up for failure. I mean, fair is fair, you know. When you encourage something and you get people coming, actually, Snowden is an example of this. Not that he's no hero, but he did this country a favor.
Yeah.
And actually, I don't know why I'm going to go right here. You know that Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, is here. My secretary when I was on the, and I was for 20 years on the education and labor committee that the Republicans called the workforce protection because they couldn't say that nasty word labor. But there are so few heroes in the Congress now to support labor that I can still call up the heads of the unions. And I have. I raised money for the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare to do a poll. I called the unions. They said yes, because they still respected what I did for them. But there should be 15 other members doing even more now. I mean, I've been gone 5 years. That's not good. On whistleblower, if you ask people to do something, you tell them they can do it, then support them when they're doing it. That's who I am.
Glad to hear. I just have one. I'm going to open up one last question, and I'm kind of inviting a spanking by raising this question. I always have to ask. Politicians and former politicians about how they honestly feel about the media and the press.
Oh.
You can say anything.
Well, I know I can. I will. I think on my list of the things that are most important in this country, I think our freedom of the press is right up there at the top.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to do something about corporate media, mm-hmm. and a few corporations owning most of the press, mm-hmm. of all kinds. But I think press and media like Fox has screwed up our country. But you know what? It wouldn't have if the country had not been willing to eat up all that stuff they say. So I have a real big problem with my local press, not in Marin, but in Sonoma. They didn't like me, but guess what? I knew how important they still were. So the press is important.
So are you at all concerned about the direct frontal assault on media that's coming out of this administration?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah, I mean, first of all, during the elections, I never could understand why Trump was on every other page of the newspaper with his picture, even though he was doing very damning, stupid stuff. He got the press. Mm-hmm. And then finally, when he became president, the press stood up for to criticize him and question him, and where were they? I don't understand that.
Yeah, well, I have no defense.
Like you, Mark.
No, it's something we think about a lot. I mean, how did we let him get away with it? Well, and a lot of that's to do with the technology that he had at his fingertips. I mean, he was able to reach 50 million people while I was taking notes. I mean, you know, that's pretty fast.
When he has a moron for a press person. I mean, and this, we don't care. It just seems so strange to me. Mm-hmm. I'm so worried about where we are, why we're here, and how we're going to get out of it. Mm-hmm. I'm truly, truly worried.
Are you at all?
I know you are.
We all are. That's why we're here. Are you at all?
Five minutes.
5 minutes. Okay. Are you at all heartened by what you're seeing here and what you're seeing with standing and the other
the Women's March, yeah, the day after the
Science March,
over the Science. Yes. I'm very heartened, and there's some good things that have come out of this. And one of them is one of my things I've been harping on, and Lynn Woolsey can harp, is where are the 50 and 45 year olds in activism? Because mm-hmm. Everything place I go, everything I was doing is, you know, here. You know, I stood in front of my Americans for Democratic Action Board and said, look, you guys, we've got to get younger people mm-hmm. here. We're going to die. You know, I mean, we've got to do it. And it's happening now. Mm-hmm. So I see, it's like something went ding, oh. You know, these 70, 80 year olds like I am, did all this, but you know, we could lose it. They're seeing it, and they're doing a good job of it, and you're doing a good job of it, I think. But the worst thing that could happen is Trump, all of this could become the new norm, and that we learn how to fight it, but we don't win the battle. And that then we become complacent, because we're a pretty comfortable group of people in America, and we can't let that be.
All right, we're going to open it up for questions from the floor. Bing is going to give you the ground rules, and Bing is strict. I would just make this request. Just remember, she's not our elected representative anymore. So we can't get up and yell at her and expect any kind of immediate action. So respect.
Thank you.
Yes, he could be impeached. He should be impeached.
Yes.
But it has to be done legally. Otherwise, we blow the whole thing. And then we get a martyr who, mm-hmm. I mean, a crazy, demented martyr who, you know, it would even be worse. So, I'm glad that the Russia situation is not going away with all the diversions that the White House is throwing out there and all the things they're trying to do to distract us, because we're people easily distracted.
Yeah.
But the one major concern I have is that it depends a lot on the FBI, mm-hmm. and they are a worry. As far as I'm concerned, I mean, they screwed up right before the election. But we have Homeland Security, we have CIA, we have other institutions. And I don't know if you've been following Adam Schiff.
Yes.
Send that guy your love and tell him thank you. Because he is doing a good job.
Look him up.
So, But let's not jump the gun mm-hmm. and go out there and make it something, you know, we can accuse, but we can't, we have to prove, so.
And then there's go from there.
Hi, I'd like to know if we could get past
getting money out of politics, I'd like to see what a perfect election would look like at all levels.
From my perspective? My perspective would be a perfect election would have a very shortened time span and a limit on funding and a limit on advertising. And if you wanted to spend all of your limit on criticizing your opponent but not saying anything about yourself, have at it. But that's all the time you'd get in the press. Europe knows how to do it. Mm-hmm. Ours might have to be, you know, we're a bigger country, so we might have to be a little longer, but we have to stop making this the one whole year, every other year of our lives is all politics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's an industry, folks. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Do you have a sense in Congress if the Democrats are really organizing behind the scenes to make some major changes? You spoke a little bit about that, but can you talk a little bit more about that?
If they are, I haven't seen it, but I'm out here, I'm on the outside of it. I think if they were gonna make major changes, Keith Ellison would have been the mm-hmm. chair of the DNC. And somehow or another, the established politics wouldn't let that happen. And I think that was a great mistake. But they have to make it happen. It has to change. Because this country is fed up with established politics. Don't believe it anymore. Blah, blah, blah. Go ahead.
Hi. So next week, the Trump's budget is supposed to come out. And part of it is to eliminate the payroll tax. And that's to give everyone in America a tax break. I want to know, is that possible for them to do without having to go through the Congress? Does the Congress vote on, and it's a technical question.
Yeah, no, it would have to go through the Congress.
Okay.
But it can be his recommendation. But he also has to then say how they're going to fill that gap. I mean, who's going to lose out when we don't have those funds? They need to have a payroll tax reduction for the low income workers. Mm-hmm. They need to have a payroll tax. They need to raise the limit on the high income earners. Mm-hmm. Same with Social Security.
So this is to eliminate the entire thing.
Yeah, well, he's just talking out of the top of his head.
Okay.
We hope.
Thank you again for all your years of service. So my question is about effective resistance, which I think was one of your first questions. And just in the spirit of a little bit of radical outside the box thinking, is a federal tax strike by as much of the citizenry as would be willing to go along with it, is that just ridiculous? Would it work? What kind of other radical resistance might be effective? Please speak from the perspective of someone who was sitting, you know, in Congress.
Well, I can speak from the perspective of withholding my taxes during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And we kept all of our taxes, we set them aside, because my husband and I. So when we had to give it up, we'd have to give it up. But yeah, you can do that. But you make sure you've got it, because when they decide that they're going to come after you for not paying your taxes, you can do it. You can pay for it.
Is it possible on scale, if really millions and millions of people did that, that we could hijack our Congress back?
Yeah, but you're not going to get millions and millions of people doing it, I don't think. But
okay. So then could you speak maybe a little outside the box thinking about effective resistance in this no more business as usual era that we're in? Thank you.
Well, I think no more business as usual has to do with supporting your representatives that are going to do the right thing for you and with you. I mean, see, you're in a bubble, you're lucky. I'm telling you, mm-hmm. how would you like to be in Indiana? Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be awful. But, so I don't know.
Would it be helpful if a bunch of us did move to those kind of districts? Here's Karl Rove's brain gerrymandering the world. Maybe progressives, we need to leave our comfort bubble and go do coalition building in super red areas. How would that work?
That would work. That would work. And actually, I don't have this well formed, these thoughts, but I just read that California is going to try to change the way supervisor elections are decided, so that there's more control, there will be even more Democrats, and I think that's a mistake if California does that, because then we're doing exactly what we're criticizing the other states for doing. So we have to be, what the effort has to be to make the other states and support, if you want to put your money where your mouth is and not go to jail for not paying your taxes, support these efforts to go to the Supreme Court and turn those laws around, mm-hmm. and challenge those states.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. it's not easy the way our government's set up. I mean, maybe I'd love it if somebody has better ideas than I do. I'd love them to tell them, but it's really not laid out clearly, because we've pretty much gotten entrenched, mm-hmm. and thought it was all okay, but it ain't.
Well, thank you both, Ms. Woolsey and Mr. Dowie, and I appreciate your candor, which I think is, well, so needed. Just a little housekeeping, we were talking about you, gerrymander, so it's a separate issue. Also, on Friday, I'm KWMR, and I encourage you to listen to your local radio station. The guest on my radio show was Leo Panish. The name will be unfamiliar to most of you. He's the editor of the Socialist Register, and we ended up discussing NAFTA. But after the NAFTA conversation came the topic of Robert Reich's book, Trapped in the Cabinet, which I encourage all of you to read. And Mr. Panish commented to me that I've been too hard on Mr. Reich and I should apologize to him. I didn't realize that 2 days later I'd get the opportunity to do that in public. So anyway, if Mr. Reich is still here, I'm sorry, and Leo Panish says hi. I can say, you know, yeah, Trump is a monster, but where does that monster come from? And I think that this is an opportunity for self-criticism, for reflection, for self-critique. This is the trends that led to the level of despair that produced Donald Trump go right across many, many Democratic administrations and Democratic Congresses, and the things that they were willing to be comfortable with pushing in terms of policy are very much to blame for Donald Trump. So very easy to pick the other and say, oh, well, what a terrible person that is. Yeah, but I think this gives us all an opportunity to reflect upon what we were willing to be content with in terms of the leadership that we have. But thank you both so much.
You're welcome, thank you. And I think that's what I've been saying, so I'm not going in on it. Yeah.
I'm here to place blame at your feet for 20 years of political inactivism. Because every once in a while I call up or send an email saying, thank you very much, as usual, for doing the right thing. And that's all I ever felt that I could do. And it took a big shock before I realized, after 20 years of that there was actually something more that needed to be done. You put us all to sleep.
Thank you. Me too. Actually, I have to tell you, one of the biggest criticisms I would get as your congressperson was, well, why can't you change the rest of the Congress? Be like you. I mean, people would just be furious at me because I couldn't. And I'd say, because the rest of the Congress doesn't work for you. And it really makes a difference who the constituents are.
So
you let me let you go to sleep. But you weren't asleep. You were one of the most active congressional districts in the nation. Believe me.
Well, we're certainly trying now.
Well, you were then too.
And you mentioned the question, what is effective resistance? So two things I wanted to mention. One is a comment, which was yesterday at the Earth Day March. I saw somebody was carrying a sign. It was a quote from Elie Wiesel, saying, sometimes we are powerless to resist inequity, but we must always protest. Or we can always protest. So even if we're powerless, still I think we have to take some kind of resistance, and that maybe it's better to resist and fail over and over and over again than not to resist at all. So part of the question, of course, is what's the most effective resistance? And part of the answer that you gave was, get money out of politics as much as you can, and get to the Supreme Court. Now with the selection of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, do you think that there's any chance that the Supreme Court is going to act in a way that will take money out of politics?
No. but the Congress can act to at least make the money that's in politics transparent. Mm-hmm. And if a bipartisan, gang, and if all communities say, to their elected officials, we want to know where that money's coming from. Mm-hmm. Transparency is the operative word. Yes, it won't. And in a constitutional amendment's going to take years and years. That somebody should start that eventually, but transparency would help. But, we might have an even worse Supreme Court before Trump gets impeached.
That's right.
And then Trump gets impeached, and then we have Pence. Well, yeah, who is, awful, except he knows what governing is. He knows what causing a world war would mean and things like that. I mean, he's not good. And he put the wrong person on the Supreme Court.
Thank you for your response.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your wonderful 20 years of service.
Thank you. And don't think that this district has been inactive. Yeah. When Barack Obama won the first time, we had a 94% voter turnout in Marin and Sonoma County.
Yeah.
And in this last election, we were up in the 80s, and no other congressional districts cared that much. So you guys, you're there.
Thank you. So my question is a pretty simple one. We do live in a bubble. Probably there's nobody here who's voted for Trump, so that we can't really look to anyone here to change their mind. But how do we affect the congressmen in Indiana or Ohio or Michigan? How do we affect them if we don't live there and we don't vote for them?
Well, that's a great question, and it's really, your hands are pretty much tied. The people you have to affect are the leadership, because the leadership works for everybody in the country. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, is your Speaker of the House as well. So they have to take your messages, your communications, and they should respond to you, but I don't know if they do. But if you wrote to a Republican congressman in Indiana, those letters, they can't do anything with those letters. Mm-hmm. They their congressional office budget disallows responding to anybody outside of your district.
Send money though.
But not the president, not his cabinet, not the leadership of both parties.
Yeah.
They work for all of you.
And
committee chairs.
Thank you.
Thank you. And ranking members.
Yes.
Hi. Hi. I have a question. Listening to Michael Moore on the Women's March on Washington. He had some really good points for us to do, and I think people are doing a great job, by the way, with town halls, calling their congresspeople, stepping up. It's amazing to watch. One of the things he said was to run for office. He said, you people have to run for office, step up. And so my question for you is, how can you encourage people and give advice on how they start that process for themselves? And not for me, but for anybody out there.
That's a great question.
First of all, I think that's half of what I do during my retired life is counsel people and running. Make sure you know why you would run. Make sure you know who you'd be running with and for and why, besides, and know what you're running for, because it isn't easy. And if you get elected and then you start deciding how you're going to make yourself fit with this district or this group that elected you, it won't work. You have to fit them to start with. Mm-hmm. Don't force fit yourself into something. But there's a way to run, and there's a way to do it positively, and there's a way to win. And I ran my first election. It was a primary. It was an open election. Barbara Boxer ran for Senate, so we had an open seat. I spent $78,000 and won that primary. It was 20 years ago, but that was no money even then, and I won.
Well, we're talking about money. I've just been reading Jane Meyer's book called Dark Money, mm-hmm. which is an astounding book of amazing research of the right-wing takeover, basically, and it's a coming. It came in just like a tsunami, and it flooded every institution in this country for decades, and now we have all of them in cabinet positions and so on. It's really a startling revelation about what's going on. And I just wondered, in your time in Congress, was there a time when you began to see this? You know, I remember you spoke here before and you talked about it used to be kind of hidden, the money that would come across the counter, but then it was more open. And I wondered if you ever really sensed this dark money, how it was being used, how much blackmail is going on, you know, how much of this is almost a conversation behind the scenes that it was no longer a secret? Because I just can't imagine that you could be in the thick of that and not realize, you know, what's happening on the fringes and some of the very dark behavior associated with this kind of money and the way they were affecting people. So could you give us some of the dirt on the dark side?
Well, there was, you know, 20 years is a long time. And I've said over and over, when I first got elected, my two major surprises was, one, how both sides of the aisle respected each other. Can you imagine that? I mean, it was so clear. Mm-hmm. People spoke to each other, they, you know, okay, there was respect. The negative surprise was it was a total mess, the scheduling, and I've never seen anything like it in my life. It was impossible. Then, by the time 20 years later, and halfway through, people stopped talking to each other so nicely. But then it got just the opposite. There was no camaraderie, and the Republicans were running the schedule, so like Mussolini, the trains ran on time. And that was the change. You know, I have to tell you, I'm sure I was too naive at the beginning to understand what money was doing. I was absolutely never would take money from anybody I couldn't support in a vote, like tobacco or oil or, you know. So I was so clear within myself that I thought, well, everybody was that way. Well, you know, it took a while, but the dark money, that comes from the press telling us, look what's happening. You know, you don't see that when you're in, you know, your leadership's not going to tell you that they got money from dark corners or something. You don't hear that and see that, but the press started telling us that. People started writing books about it.
When we can find it. Dark money is very, very hard to find. I just did a long, long investigative report on the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is just swimming in dark money. Yeah. Well, and I could not find more than a few bucks of that money. That Jane Meyer, who Elizabeth mentioned, was really, really good at finding dark money, and she's been following it for longer than I have. So, she told us where it was.
I'm going to look.
You know, at first, you don't want to believe it, you maybe deny, but eventually it's so clear, you can't deny it. But, I mean, there are, I believe, and this is conspiracy theorist-y, I believe there's a handful of people in this world, it's not our country, it's worldwide, that are trying to run everything.
X-Files.
And they probably already are.
Go ahead.
We only have about 7 minutes left, and there are 3 people, so it'd be nice to equalize it a bit.
So go fast, and I won't talk for a long time.
Thanks for your integrity. I'm going to follow on from what you've just talked about. I'm an immigrant, and I'm a student of deep state history, and for 15 years. And I wonder if you're familiar with the works of Professor Carol Quigley. Because if you read Professor Quigley and Professor Anthony Sutton and other academics who are not talked about, you will actually discover that politics, as we've been discussing tonight, actually makes no difference at all. I know this is unpopular for most people here. I'm a follower of Gandhi, who talked about experiments in truth. And I think this is right now an experiment in truth, because I don't want to say this. But Professor Quigley essentially said that it is groups like the Council on Foreign Relations and other dark money powers that you just refers to that are essentially running the country, have done since the First World War, invested in both Nazi Germany and the Bolsheviks, and have called every presidential election since then. So if you want to comment about that, I'd be happy to hear what you have to say about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comment.
I'll try to make this fast. But first of all, I should say, you look terrific.
Better than yes.
The retirement really seems to
yeah.
be
except
any time when you were in Congress.
My life is less trying.
After all those hard questions, I'll ask you an easy one. You've talked about the peace in the Middle East as being one of the priorities. Can you be a little more specific, let's say, about Syria, Iran, and the Israel?
No, that's above my pay grade now.
And
I'd be shooting off the top of my head in all of that. All I know is humans have to learn worldwide how humanity needs to be supported, or we're going to self-destruct. Yeah. It, not just there. We have to learn to get along and love each other for crying out loud.
Any hints you might give us?
No, I'm not. I have no inside scoop on any of that. But I wake up every morning in turmoil and can't figure out what should be done.
One more question. Thank you.
I wanted to piggyback on a comment that was, or a question that was made earlier regarding Michael Moore's exhortation and encouragement that we, you and I, consider running for congressional offices, municipal opportunities, that sort of thing. So wondering if you are aware of any retired congresspeople, legislators that are actually working on that, providing think tank consultations, support for people who want to run for offices.
Well, Secretary Rice told me that more than 50% of retired congresspeople become lobbyists, so I'm sure there's some offices around the country that are getting paid big bucks to help people run for office.
Yeah,
so
I think it would be splendid for whole core of you folks to begin to help the rest of us step up and do that.
Right. Well, I'd like to say, from my perspective, the most important things, as I said, about
fixing what's going wrong has to do with getting money out of politics, opening up the press on all levels, print, electronic, to everybody, not just corporations. Having an education system that teaches people how to think and care. Supporting our workers and their families. And of course, protecting this environment that is so dear to us. And if we can do that, we'll be good forever.
Yeah, I should tell you, give you a little hope, I hope, that my tribe of investigative reporters are stimulated by current events, and regard the government as now as a target-rich environment. And we are meeting using undisclosed locations around the country and plotting where to do, where, how to focus, what to do next. And I can promise you that the level of investigative reporting that has already occurred since November 9th is just getting started.
Joining us this evening and sharing your perspectives. Thank you so much.